they all see something that I personally hope that I never see. There's a clown walking up to the house.
Welcome to the Brothers in Crime podcast.
We are brothers.
We talk about true crime.
We don't take ourselves too seriously.
And you shouldn't either.
Marlene Mae McKinnon was born on April 15th, 1950, in Mount Clemens, Michigan. She grew up on her grandfather's farm in the town of about 17,000, according to the 1950s census. It sits 20 miles northeast of Detroit. She was a middle child with two sisters, and her mother and stepfather said that she was always smiling, kind, loving, and helpful. So you have nothing to worry about, Bob. You're never going to be somebody that gets talked about on a true crime podcast.
Good.
Marlene married young. We can relate to that. And at 18, she had two boys, John and Joe. But unfortunately, tragedy struck the young family early on. Marlene's husband died in a car accident. Marlene, barely 20, was a widow with two young children to raise, care, and provide for. Despite the hardship and responsibility she faced, Marlene was crushing it. Everybody has described how awesome of a mother she was, and she wouldn't be alone for too long. When Joe was just 3 years old, Marlene met a man named Michael Warren, who went by Mike. She was quickly smitten, and the two got married. Mike had been Joe's dad basically as long as he could remember. The family was thriving, and Marlene and Mike decided to make a move to South Florida for a fresh start. They eventually settled down in Wellington, Florida. They were doing pretty well for themselves. They owned some businesses together. Marlene kind of managed these apartment complexes or these different rental properties. And some of these were, I think, you know, it was kind of like a joint venture kind of thing, but she sort of handled the day-to-day stuff and really managed and took care of the business for those. And as things, you know, bigger and better, as they were able to add more of these properties to their portfolio, eventually Mike took on a car lot known as Bargain Motors. And then he handled sort of the day-to-day operations and ran that place while she was taking care of their rental property enterprise. And they lived in this nice neighborhood, like I said, called Wellington Aero Club. In fact, Bob, it kind of reminds me of a place you'd live.
Only if it said mobile home park at the end of it. But anyway, tell us a beef Wellington place. Tell us more.
According to WellingtonAeroClub.net, the neighborhood's website, which I'm sure the mobile home parks you've lived in had websites too.
Yeah.
Wellington Aero Club is a private aeronautical community located in the village of Wellington, Florida. It features 240 custom-built homes on one-acre lots, many with private hangars and a lighted and paved 4,000-foot runway. Sound familiar?
If you got enough money to pay for a house like that, because you know that shit ain't cheap, I want more than 1 acre. I want 100 acres and a moat and an electric fence.
Yeah, but to city folk, an acre is, like, you know, huge.
I guess.
That's a lot of grass to take care of. Now, although Wellington is technically a village, it is the largest village in Florida, just west of West Palm Beach and an hour or so north of Miami. It's been home to a few folks whose names you might recognize, such as Bill Gates, Glenn Close, Vanilla Ice, Bruce Springsteen, Tommy Lee Jones, and Madonna.
Oh, snazzy.
But despite a comfortable lifestyle and a relationship that to many people seemed normal, there were some issues beneath the surface.
Always are.
Right. About 18 years after Marlene lost her first husband, she suffered another devastating loss. John, her oldest son, was also involved in a fatal car accident. Responders found him dead on the scene, and that was in 1988, but unfortunately, more tragedy was right around the corner. Marlene suspected that Mike was having an affair, and she had some other concerns, too.
What do you mean, what concerns?
Well, Joe, remember, that's her only son who's left living at this point, and her youngest son, says that his mom told him, quote, "If anything does happen to me, your father did it."
Damn, that's not good. I want more information at that point.
Yeah, I mean, Joe couldn't believe it. He pushed back. He said he didn't argue with his mom, but he was just sort of in disbelief. But his mom insisted, and Joe wasn't the only person that has said that Marlene told them this. In fact, she told her mother, Shirley. Her mom could sense fear in Marlene's voice when she relayed this information.
That Mike wasn't a good dude?
Yeah, that she just had this fear that if anything happened to her, Mike had something to do with it. Now, let's fast forward Saturday, May 26, 1990. It's Memorial Day weekend. Joe's 21. He's staying with his mom and stepdad, Mike. And he's also recuperating from a broken leg. He's got like a kind of a cast thing on there. And so he's there with his messed up leg and having breakfast with three of his friends and his mom. She made some breakfast for him. And they're all kind of hanging out together. And then they all see something that I personally hope that I never see. There's a clown walking up to the house.
Okay.
To be clear, like, I don't have some weird phobia of clowns. I just feel like if an uninvited random clown is walking up to my front door, we got problems.
Yeah, I don't, like you, I'm not, I don't have that clown fear or anything. I find them kind of annoying, so I certainly don't seek them out, and I don't really like anybody walking up to my house, especially some clown.
Agreed, agreed.
Of course, most people who walk up to my house are clowns, just not wearing the uniform.
Right, so this clown is wearing the uniform, and is carrying balloons and flowers, and so given Joe's injuries, the group's sort of thinking, well, maybe it's this gesture, these flowers are for Joe, and so either way, whatever, they're not alarmed by this clown.
I get maybe somebody, they're thinking somebody sent him a telegram or something.
Yeah, right, right. And, yeah, so anyway, I'll touch some more on this in a minute. But so Marlene goes over to the door, and she opens it. And there's this clown with balloons and flowers. And Joe said that he heard his mom remark about how pretty the flowers were. And then the clown pulled out a gun and shot Marlene in the face.
Oh, damn.
The clown walked off like nothing had happened, and got into a white LeBaron. Am I saying that right, since you criticized my old car pronunciation? It's a Chrysler?
Yeah, that's not so old. A Chrysler, okay. LeBaron. Those were still being made in the 80s and early 90s.
It's from your generation, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I first was reading about this case, I read this as LeBron. And then I said, wait, no, that's not right. Anyway, so the clown gets in this LeBaron and just doesn't peel out, doesn't take off, doesn't speed off. Literally just, like they made, you know, the singing telegram delivery. They just get in the car and slowly leave like everything was normal. Joe and his friends got in Marlene's car and they tried to chase down the clown, but they weren't able to catch up.
I guess so. Joe's got a freaking broken leg, so he's hobbling out there. So the clown's in a white LeBaron and these guys look like clowns getting in a clown car.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's you know, you gotta, I don't blame him for trying, but yeah, he's at a big disadvantage here. But I want to pause because I held back an interesting detail about Marlene when I was talking about who she was.
Oh, come on. You can't hold out on me.
Marlene, since she was younger, had, I wouldn't say a fascination, but she loved clowns. She had actually painted pictures of clowns, and her mom is where she got it from. Her mom loved clowns too, so they had this like love and sort of appreciation for clowns. So the fact that a clown showed up at her door, not only would it be like, it's almost the opposite of you or me. She's almost like excited, like, oh, there's a clown here. This is great.
Was she like into clowns, like something she liked, like people are into dolphins or they're into butterflies and she was into, yeah, clowns? Or was it more of a fetish thing, like she was a chuckle?
The former. Yeah, in fact, like I said, she painted some paintings of clowns that her mom held on to, and these were from like when she was like 14 or 15 or something. They're actually really good. I mean, I can't even correctly draw a stick figure, but she had some talent. And like I said, so they were into clowns, and so this just made it even more bizarre that the way this all unfolded, right? So first responders show up, they rush Marlene to the hospital, and she's basically put on life support right away. She's shot in the face, I think, from what I read. The bullet was lodged in her C2 vertebra. You care to kind of elaborate on where that might be?
Yeah, that's right at the top of your spinal column. And C1 and C2 are called the atlas and the axis. I mean, they're right there at the brainstem. And if you get a injury to the spinal cord there, you lose all function. Like, you can't do, you know, body no work no more.
Yeah, and so that's pretty much my understanding of what happened in her case. And so 2 days later, on Memorial Day, without any expectation that Marlene could possibly recover, basically the prognosis was, there was no prognosis, the decision was made and she was taken off of life support and she died. Investigators asked Joe if he could provide a description of the shooter. He noted that the clown had big brown eyes, was tall, probably about 6'1", was skinny but had broad shoulders and big hands, with orange hair, a red nose, and a big orange painted smile. Joe also described the clown as a man.
Are you serious?
I read this so many times, and I I was like, I don't know if I can say this without laughing, but yes, this is actually in the report.
And he was carrying a really long handkerchief too.
Right.
And he had big feet.
Well, what's interesting is that's one of the questions from the investigators is, did he have on clown shoes? And no, he had on these like tactical boots essentially. So they did not match the outfit.
A tactical clown. That's interesting.
it's an assault clown.
Yeah. When I first started reading this and I read the clown had big brown eyes, my first thought there was, you got to take that with a grain of salt, because if you're looking at a clown, his face is painted, and every clown with their face painted, their eyes seem to pop out at you more.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have looked big, but who knows? Doesn't mean he was a freaking, you know, hound or anything that had them big puppy dog eyes.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this is a wise decision from the standpoint of somebody who doesn't want to be known, right? In that sense, even though it's terrible, it's a good disguise.
Yeah,
for sure. So the two balloons that the clown brought were left floating inside the house. The clown did not take the balloons with them, but left them behind. And one said, "You're the greatest." And the other had Snow White and the Seven Dwarves on it. Now, Joe told them about the car the clown got into, that white LeBaron, so they immediately put out a bolo. Police started investigating, and it wouldn't take long for them to develop suspect.
So Marlene died. What happens to all of her rental properties and business and all that? Did that go to, I guess Joe was the only one left as far as kids go, or mm-hmm. or hubby?
Right. So, yeah, it's a good point, right? Follow the money. So Michael Warren, Mike, he makes out as a result of Marlene's death. He's clearly got the most to gain. He ends up with 100% of the assets that were in her name or both of their names. And remember, we're talking about a car dealership, over a dozen rental properties. I mean, there's a significant amount of assets.
Yeah, it's definitely not chump change.
And following the money is smart, but let's back up for a second. First, it didn't seem like Marlene had any enemies. So initially, the leads investigators had were those two balloons and the flowers.
What kind of flowers were they?
These were carnations.
Okay.
And they were in a basket. It was a basket of carnations. But like a arrangement. So this wasn't like, you know, she just grabbed... you know what I mean?
Well, we got to check out these balloons, because I don't know. If they were blown up at the store and they have helium in them, no good. But, you know, if Bozo there had to blow them up itself, you could have DNA from his big old, you know, clown makeup orange probably on the balloons.
So you're on a good track here, because you're talking about, you know, like trying to track down where this stuff came from. That's smart.
What about, so he shot her, any shell casings or anything? Did he accidentally drop the gun maybe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you would kind of expect something like that from a clown, but no, there were no shell casings or any gun left at the scene. Really, what they had to go on at that moment was these balloons, which, you know, you say, let's check those out, and the flowers. Now, for the balloons, these are those, like, foil-style, the kind you would expect to be blown up with helium, and they, you know, that kind of balloon.
Okay, so we're not going to have his lips on the blowhole.
That is correct. So investigators go to local stores to try to figure out where the killer got the balloons and the flowers. And they caught a break, because the balloon that said, "You're the greatest," which was heart-shaped, by the way, was only sold in one store, a nearby Publix grocery store. And there were two employees at the Publix who remembered selling that same combination of flowers and balloons to somebody less than 2 hours before Marlene was shot. Police also called all the costume shops in the area until they found a West Palm Beach shop where two employees said that they'd sold a clown costume to someone just a few days before the murder. A woman named Deborah Offord worked in that West Palm Beach shop called Spotlight Capizio Shop. She told investigators that she had locked the doors and was closing up for the night on the 24th when somebody knocked on the door. The person asked if they could come in and grab what they needed. Deborah and a coworker said, like, "Hey, you know, we're closed. Why don't you come back tomorrow?" But this person was insistent. They said, "No, I need this tonight, and it won't take me long because I know exactly what I need." And they were insistent and persistent enough that Deborah finally relented and let them in. The person quickly picked out a standard clown suit along with a curly wig, a sponge nose, and clown makeup. They picked all the cheapest options for each of those items. And interestingly, they asked Deborah for extra white makeup because they needed to make sure that their face was completely covered.
Like, yeah.
Deborah described the person as around 5'8", wearing jeans, a plaid button-up shirt, and work boots, maybe like tactical boots. They were uninterested in purchasing any clown shoes. There was another thing, though. Deborah and her coworker told police that the person who bought the clown gear was a woman.
Oh, damn.
4 days after the murder, the employees at that at a Winn-Dixie called police to report an abandoned vehicle in the parking lot. Employees had said that this car had been there for a few days, and it turned out to be a white Chrysler LeBaron. Investigators took the car in for processing, and they found orange curly fibers in the car they thought were probably consistent with the hair, like from a clown wig, and they were sent out for analysis, and eventually they were determined to be acrylic, and that supported sort of their thinking that these were, you know, from some sort of clown costume.
Oh, okay. I was beginning to suspect Carrot Top there for a minute.
I mean, you know, where was he in around Miami in 1990? The license plate was traced back to Payless Car Rental, which was a competitor of Bargain Motors. In fact, Mike had taken out an ad in the Yellow Pages that said Payless, all huge, all one word, essentially just like the name of the business, and very large. But then he had included his business number under that. So essentially the ad looked like it's an ad for Payless, but when you would call the number, you would get Bargain Motors.
Right, so either one you call, either ad you call from, you're getting a bargain.
Bingo. So Bob, you want to explain what Yellow Pages are for our Gen Z listeners at home?
Oh, it was this god-awful system that they still exist today, sort of, but not like it used to. There's this thing called a phone book. And if you wanted to call somebody, you didn't Google their number or anything like that. You went to the phone book, and in the White Pages, you looked up a person by their city, town, county, depending on what kind of area you were in, and their name, and found their number to call them. And then the Yellow Pages were how the phone books and the phone companies made money. Those were all listings, but the companies had to pay to be in the Yellow Pages for anything other than a just little one-line teeny ad that nobody saw. So if you needed a plumber or you needed a lawyer, and lawyers always had full-page ads because those idiots have more money than sense, whatever you needed, you'd go to the Yellow Pages, look it up. You're looking for a car dealer, you go to the C's and look for a car dealer. Actually, that'd probably be, you would find a C automobile dealer's new used and flip back to there, and so you have a page, and depending on how much they spent, they might have a full page ad, a half page ad, a quarter page, or some little, you know, they sold them by the inch too. You could have a 2-inch, you know, one column ad, and this thing only came out once a year. So when you went to the phone book and looked things up, any business that was new wasn't going to be in there. Anything changed its number wasn't going to be in there. And anything that had just started up new or things that had gone out of business were going to be in there. She'd be calling things that didn't even freaking exist anymore. And yeah, it was horrible. And the worst part about it is to be unlisted, if you didn't want your phone number to appear in the phone book, you had to pay extra to have an unlisted number. So you had to pay the phone company not to print your name and number in the phone book. Made no damn sense.
Mm. I feel like I just unlocked a trigger there. I could see you feel some kind of way about all that.
Hey, look, I might be a Gen Xer and kind of old, but don't forget, my people are up on technology, and these things were not fun for us.
That's fair. And just to clarify, or to kind of emphasize the point, right? So this is, you know, 1990, we're pre-Google days. So if you wanted to find a place to rent a car or buy a car or whatever, you had word of mouth, and you had basically this, you'd turn to the Yellow Pages to try to find a place to get a car. So the fact that Mike, you know, took out this ad and then put his phone number under this what looked like Payless's ad, this wasn't just some kind of turdly thing that he did. I mean, it was a big deal. It had real world consequences and cost Payless a lot of money. In fact, it prompted Payless to file a civil lawsuit against Bargain Motors. But yeah, we don't need to get into that for the podcast. Interestingly, for our criminal case here, Payless had reported a LeBaron stolen about 2 weeks before the murder. Investigators learned that it had been rented, and the people who rented it had called Bargain Motors because of the misleading ad, and somebody there told them, oh, just leave it outside the gate and put the keys on the windshield underneath the windshield wipers. So the people who rented the car did just that, and unsurprisingly, the car was stolen.
Imagine that.
A week or so later, the LeBaron was, this LeBaron is the exact same one that's used in Marlene's murder. So while detectives are looking into Mike's business dealings and a possible connection to Marlene's murder, they found that he was being investigated by other authorities for suspicion of rolling back odometers on the vehicles at Bargain Motors.
Uh-oh.
And really, this whole thing just kind of accelerates the investigation into all of these questionable business practices. Now, nowadays, most odometers are digital, but there's been movies, this has been referenced in and stuff, where when odometers, the thing that counts your miles on your car, used to be mechanical, you could kind of go in and you could essentially roll back the odometer so that a car that had, say, 80 or 100,000 miles looked like it only had 10,000 miles or 40,000 miles or whatever.
Yeah, the manufacturers try to do things to deter that, but if you knew what you're doing, it was totally possible to roll back odometers. Now every car has a bunch of computers with data stored on it, so you can't get away with it. But back then, it was just figuring out how to mechanically get it turned back.
Yeah, if you were enterprising and mechanically inclined, no big deal. Now this also, at this point in the investigation, this is kind of when police learn that Mike is rumored to be having an affair with a woman named Sheila Keen, a woman who worked at Bargain Motors.
What kind of rumors?
Well, employees said that they had seen Mike and Sheila engaging in sexual acts in his office during work hours, but Mike and Sheila denied any sort of relationship. It was maybe one of the worst kept secrets in the entire dealership. Sheila was a repo woman for Bargain Motors, and she was married at the time to a guy named Spud. That was his nickname, but that's just what I'm going to call him because it's too good not to use. Now, side note, in case you were wondering what kind of fella Spud was, he'd been in the KKK and prison for running weed.
No, nice fella.
Yeah, so we're just going to leave it at Spud and move on. So eventually, Sheila would leave Spud, and people were talking about the relationship that Sheila had with Mike. In fact, neighbors at an apartment that Sheila moved into all by herself believed that Mike was her husband because he was there so much. They didn't even know Spud was in the picture. And that was without the neighbors knowing that Mike was the one who was actually paying for her apartment. Now, on October 25th, 1990, police executed a search warrant at Bargain Motors. They found enough damaging evidence to arrest Mike, and on the next day, he was arrested, and he's hit with over 60 charges, including the odometer tampering, grand theft, and racketeering.
Oh, damn, he's in trouble.
Now, the police had good evidence now that Mike had been repossessing vehicles he sold through his dealership, then reporting them stolen and collecting the insurance money.
Nice racket.
Yeah, I mean, he had a game figured out, and honestly, it was probably a lot of hard work to do this. It was just completely illegal. And while all this is going on, police still hadn't charged anybody for Marlene's murder. As other legal trouble found Mike, more and more stories and information came to light that seemed to make you kind of scratch your head about this guy. He had previously owned a plane, because remember, they live in this fancy schmancy, Aero Club place, and he had reported it missing or stolen, but it was later found with a broken engine. He also owned some racehorses, which are quite expensive, and one randomly turned up dead. So there had just been all these things that were going on that didn't really make sense, and it seemed like he just was this guy that seemed to have an awful, crazy string of interesting, terrible things happening to him.
It seems like this guy was a walking, talking fraud and the stereotypical used car salesman. I already know he had Marlene killed. And I mean, there's no suspense here. It's going to be a hell of a twist if we get to the end of this and it wasn't him that was either behind it and Spud's old lady was in the costume, or I don't know if he was. But
can you caveat that with that's your personal opinion and not a fact?
Well, yeah, I'm just telling you, I'm going to be shocked if we get to the end of this and it wasn't old Mikey's doing.
All right, okay, that's fair. All right. Now, some people who knew the Warrens a little bit better than others said that Marlene and Mike's relationship was in trouble, and I alluded to this earlier. Apparently, it was in enough trouble that they knew that getting a divorce was going to be super complicated due to just how complex their assets and their business ventures were. It was essentially a lot to try to untangle with the various rental properties, the way things were structured, the assets in the car dealership. It just made a divorce essentially like not practical and unfeasible. And around this point in their marriage, Mike was spending more and more time at work and less time at home.
Oh, you mean he was spending time, him and Sheila were on his desk priming the fuel pump?
Pretty much. And so in 1992, Mike was tried for those 60 charges stemming out of his business practices, and I'm being nice there, at Bargain Motors. During his trial, an assistant state's attorney mentioned that Mike was suspected of being involved in the murder of his wife, Marlene.
How's that allowable?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a scenario under those circumstances where that would be okay. And I'm not sure why the prosecutor said that. I mean, sometimes, you know, lawyers say silly things. I know you would agree with that. But I can tell you that it didn't result in a mistrial. Instead, the defense attorney turned it into an argument that he used with the jury that the police were out here just railroading Mike to ultimately charge him with the murder, and that these charges were essentially these trumped up things they were trying to get him on because they couldn't get him for the murder. Now, the defense had some mixed success with this, but the jury ultimately convicted Mike on 43 counts, and he was sentenced to 9 years in prison. He went off to prison, and Joe says that's when the two became estranged at that point.
But, that's when Joe and Mike
sort
of parted ways.
Yeah, it's kind of like the end of them having any sort of relationship. Once he goes off to prison on the business stuff, they just kind of, went their separate ways. But remember, Marlene had told Joe, her son, and her mom, Shirley, that if anything happened to her, it was Mike. They saw this, him going to prison for a few years on these business-related things as sort of a hollow victory, if even that. I mean, sure, Mike was going to go to prison for a little while, but nobody had even been charged with Marlene's murder yet. Now, investigators were also suspicious of Mike.
You think?
But remember, Mike had that rock-solid alibi, and everything police had against him was circumstantial.
Wait, what alibi?
Oh, I don't think I think I skipped over this. I'm sorry. This is an important detail. I'm glad you brought it up. Okay, so the morning of the clown shooting, Mike has what police have determined is a rock-solid alibi. He's in a car with a few of his friends. They're on their way to a racetrack, and they had left early enough and were gone long enough that there was essentially there was no possible way that he was involved in the shooting. They were confident that there was no question he was not the person who pulled the trigger.
That's fine. I don't understand this, why all documentaries do this and they go, oh, well, he had a rock solid alibi. He wasn't involved. No, all that means is that he wasn't there. He didn't pull the trigger. That doesn't mean he wasn't involved. Come on.
You thinking like old Dana that we talked about not that long ago?
I think there are plenty of people who have masterminded the murder of others that managed to keep their hands clean.
Hey, don't incriminate yourself. Be careful here.
I'm not. I mean, John Gotti, when his son Frankie got run over on the bicycle, you know, accident by the neighbor, and then John and his wife take a trip to Florida, and mysteriously, the neighbor disappears, and we now know was killed. Now, you're going to tell me John went behind that? Come on.
But he was in Florida.
Exactly.
So back to catch back up. Thanks for pointing that out. I missed that earlier. All right. So one day the police receive an anonymous phone call telling them that they need to look into a woman named Sheila Keene, the woman that people said Mike was spending a lot of time with. The anonymous caller told police that the two of them knew exactly what had happened to Marlene, the two of them being Mike and Sheila.
Okay, why weren't they looking at her right from... Why'd they have to wait for this phone call? Like, why wouldn't she be, like, right up there on the person of interest list since she had this, like, you know, entanglement with Mike already?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And they were looking at her. But remember, even though the cops were looking into her and kind of seeing that she looked like an interesting person in this case, Joe's initial report of the shooter, 6'1", broad shoulders, big hands, a man, Sheila ain't exactly that.
Okay, I get that. But number one, this person was in a clown costume. And number two, the minute you told me that she was a repo woman, this is not a dainty sundress wearing little lady that sits behind the desk with her legs crossed at the ankle. She can get down. So I want to, like, right then, like, I wanted to see that woman right away.
That's fair. Let's talk about
it. And in this clown costume and the Joe saying a person was 6'1", and you say this chick's 5'8", who really can tell the difference between 5'8 and 6'1"? Unless somebody is walking out of a 7-Eleven when I tell you how tall they are and they have that measuring stick up against the door, I couldn't freaking tell you. I can tell you generally they're taller than me or shorter than me, but not much more than that.
That's fair. That's all good points. Well, let's go ahead and talk about Sheila for just a hot second. So she grew up down in the farming communities of Florida. Picture kind of like small country town. You know, there's like animals and crops, sugar cane groves, fruit groves, things like that. She was often described as pretty with very long brown hair. And she also had big brown eyes. Remember, I said that she was married when she first met Mike, right?
Yeah.
Well, at that time, Sheila was 27, Mike was almost 40, so he's just a little bit older. She's a repo woman at Bargain Motors, and others described her as fearless. Some of the coworkers talked about how she would carry a gun when she would go into some of these rougher areas to repo cars. So, to the point that you just made, yeah, she kind of fits that pretty well to a T.
I told you, she could get down.
Yeah, and even though Mike wanted out of his marriage and stood to gain everything financially from Marlene's death, Sheila generally fit the description of the shooter once you ignore the man part. And she perfectly matched the description of the woman who bought flowers, balloons, and the clown costume. But police didn't think they had enough to charge anybody with anything related to Marlene's murder. So the case went cold. Now, Mike served his time on the Bargain Motors charges. And do you know what he did when he got out of prison?
Something stupid, no doubt.
Well, I'm going to jump around a little bit in time here. But I'm going to lead with the what I think is the most interesting part. So fast forward a few years after him getting out of prison. And in 2002, he hooked up with Sheila and they went to Las Vegas and got married at the Little White Chapel.
I told you. Something stupid.
Yeah, so Marlene's parents felt about the same about that. Mike's new wife definitely didn't make them happy. And this seems to be the point where Marlene's mom goes from having this suspicion about Mike based on just what her daughter said to now at this point, like, he's basically dead to her. The fact that he went off and married Sheila when she seemed like she could have been a suspect in the case and he was having an affair with her and all this other stuff.
Yeah, if there was any doubt, he just removed it.
Yeah, pretty much. But even despite this, really what seems like a great circumstantial case, the case would just continue to languish. Nothing happened really at all for the next decade. It wouldn't be until the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office received a federal grant for $125,000 to re-examine some of their cold cases that they made any real headway. But at that point, they reopened Marlene's case and had two things that they didn't have before. Extra money and solid DNA technology. Remember, Marlene was murdered in 1990, so DNA testing in the mid-2010s is literally worlds more advanced. There's also fresh talent in the sheriff's and prosecutor's offices.
A new set of eyes can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah, and the first thing that the detectives now assigned to Marlene's case did was to re-examine the physical evidence from that Chrysler LeBaron. They sent the curly synthetic fibers that they believed came from the clown wig in for testing, and they also sent strands of what looked like long brown hair that were in the car.
So the orange short and curlies, and then the brown hair?
Yeah, that's what they thought. They looked at it, and they suspected that it was actual human hair, and they were hopeful that the lab could pull DNA from it.
So what were idiot Mike and Big Sheila doing at this point?
this part could be an entire podcast episode in and of itself. But I'm going to try to give you the short version. So Mike gets out of prison in the mid-late 90s, or around this mid-90s point. And at that time, he ends up starting a restaurant in Kingsport, Tennessee with Sheila. And you'll never guess the name, so I'm just going to tell you. It was called the Purple Cow.
What?
Yeah, and there's purple cows. It's weird. I don't know. And to answer an easier question, you care to guess? Oh, I gave it away. I was going to ask you who owned the business with him, but I already told you. It was Sheila.
No shocker there.
Right. So in addition to this business in Tennessee, they bought a massive lake house across the border in Virginia, a little town called Abingdon. Eventually, they'd retire full-time to their lake house there, selling the Purple Cow in 2017 for reasons that I'll explain in a moment. Now, you might find it interesting to know that Sheila didn't really exist anymore. If you asked anybody who knew Mike, the people that worked at the Purple Cow for them, the neighbors, their neighbors, and anybody in their orbit, they would tell you about Mike and Debbie, his woman with blonde hair.
Oh, well, Debbie is Sheila. Sheila is Debbie.
Indeed, she had changed her name to Debbie and dyed her hair blonde. Now, getting back to this case and what was happening in Florida, the lab was able to confirm that the hairs from the LeBaron were a substantial match to Sheila. Now, prosecutors and investigators would say that they matched her. Her defense attorney would go on to say that there was a little bit of wiggle room that potentially maybe there was a match to somebody else, but it seems pretty clear that at worst, the DNA evidence pointed toward Sheila being the person who left the hairs in that car.
All right, now was this match part of that quackery that was going on for a while on matching hairs, or was this actual DNA?
Yeah, this was not microscopic hair analysis, which has been confirmed to just be junk science. This was actual DNA testing. And I think what happened was some of the hair, there was some mixed profiles. There was some other DNA that kind of polluted the sample, something like that. Because my understanding is, like, on one of the hairs, there was female and male DNA that was recovered from the hair. And you think about it, right? The hair is recovered from the car. There's DNA in the car. So even if you're able to pull it, if there's touch DNA or something else, it could kind of pollute the sample. And I think that kind of went to some of this. And there's
but they can still get numbers from that. I mean, they can still give you odds of how likely or not that part of that sample was contributed to by this or that person. I'm sure there was DNA in that car. It sounds like Mike and Sheila were spreading their DNA everywhere.
Right. Yeah. So ultimately, this is one of those things. I only bring up to kind of hedge the bet that the defense attorney claims this isn't as good as the state claims. But I think it's pretty solid that it points to Sheila, but there's still a problem with that, and I'll get into that in a second. So, on September 26, 2017, Mike and Sheila are driving back home in their Cadillac Escalade from a road trip to Vermont that they had taken when they were stopped by police.
What's the change of leaves, the fall of leaves? They had to take that trip.
You gotta go.
Up to
you gotta, New England. They probably went to Ben and Jerry's up there. I mean, that's...
No, screw those two.
As one does. Police had an arrest warrant for Sheila for the murder of Marlene Warren. Sheila was taken into custody, and Mike drove off in their Escalade because police felt they didn't have enough evidence to charge him with anything. Despite the lack of evidence, Joe has said he wants to see Mike charged with his mother's murder. On the other hand, Mike says he had nothing to do with it, and he doesn't believe Sheila had anything to do with it either. You got any thoughts about that, Bob?
At this point, I'll say it is possible that he wasn't involved in the planning or execution, but I don't believe for a minute he believes she didn't have any... I mean, come on. He's got to know. He had to know after the fact that she done did it. Or he's the dumbest person on the planet.
Well, the case against Sheila in and of itself was a wild ride. This thing went from her being notified that the state was seeking the death penalty to an incredibly favorable plea deal for Sheila. Now, although the hairs in the LeBaron were consistent with Sheila's DNA, her lawyer offered an explanation for that, even above and beyond the question about whether it was actually a complete match to her or not. He said, of course they would find her DNA in the car or her hair in the car. She worked at the dealership. It wouldn't be surprising for her to be in the car or to be in cars at the dealership.
The car the dealership didn't own.
Yeah, but...
Because this was Payless's car.
Right. That's a great point. That's a great point. But it had ended up, you know, there was this whole thing where...
Oh, I'm sure they said that was some misunderstanding or something. And
no, they basically came out that... remember how I told you that the people who rented the car had called Bargain? Somebody at Bargain had said, oh, yeah, just leave it here.
Yeah.
So they did that on purpose to mess with Payless in retaliation for the lawsuit. And so they went and took this car, essentially, and stole it from Payless.
Sure. Oh, you mean, okay.
Bargain was like, they kind of fessed up to like, yeah, we did that as a, put our thumb in their eye.
Well, I knew Bargain did that intentionally. What I was thinking was initially that whoever was doing the killing sort of fell into their lap of, look, I now have access to this vehicle that's off the books.
Right.
I'll just go use it for that and drop it and be done. Not that they actually, like, stole the car and used it for other things.
Exactly.
But, yeah, if this was on the Bargain Motors lot for any period of time, they could have explain that hair away by saying, I mean, everybody knows about the affair at this point, so she could have been like, yeah, I was banging the boss in that car.
Right.
You know, I got pictures you want to see.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, if you came the next morning, you'd have found my panties on the rearview mirror.
So the defense lawyer also planned to make some hay with the inconsistent descriptions. So, and we've kind of fleshed this out, but remember, Joe initially said this clown was a 6'1" man and Sheila was a 5'7", 5'8" woman. As if that wasn't bad enough, the defense lawyer could also argue that the evidence had not been properly preserved. I haven't told you about this yet. There was potential cross-contamination, and he would argue that none of this evidence was reliable enough that it should be admitted in court. The problem was, several of these evidence bags were torn and or opened while they sat in evidence, and this left that evidence, the physical evidence the state was relying on to convict Sheila, exposed to the elements, to people who came in the room, to other evidence in the container, in the box, and seriously undercut it. I'm making up words. Seriously undercut the reliability of that evidence. And I thought you'd have something to say about chain of evidence and that kind of thing.
I don't understand why we still have these simple mistakes in the year 2000 something. Like, it's all brand new to us.
Yeah, and the prosecution, they've kind of offered some, you know, they understand it's bad, but what they've said is, you know, hey, look, you're talking about, what, the better part of 20-some years, lots of different agencies, lots of different cops, lots of different labs, but I'm with you. I mean, yeah, I get it. Nobody's perfect, whatever, but I've seen the pictures of this stuff, and it really is like you've got these, like the brown, not like the grocery bag style, but like the brown evidence bags that can be sealed shut, but then they're just, somebody cut it open at some point and then just left it like that, just open.
Nice.
Which, when you're talking about evidence that you're trying to recover DNA from and you're trying to test for, you know, different analyses, you can't do that. That's just not okay. So, definitely not great for the state. And so, during the pendency of this case, the state ends up taking the death penalty off the table. The case would drag on from 2017 until the spring of 2023.
You freaking lawyers. Like, why does it take so long to do anything?
Well, in addition to the usual lawyer delays, there was this other thing you may have heard of in 2020, COVID something or other, I don't know. And that created some real delays in the whole world, as most of us who were alive at that point know. But in this case particularly, it hampered things and it made things drag on even longer. Unfortunately, in March 2023, Shirley Twing, Marlene's mom, died. She would not get to see any form of justice or closure or whatever you want to call it in her daughter's case. But the following month, on April 25th, 2023, Sheila Keen Warren, at this point, pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. Now remember, Mike sold the purple cow in 2017. That was shortly after Sheila was arrested and the case got underway. Well, in December of 2023, he bought the restaurant back. Mike Warren is, again, the owner of the Purple Cow in Kingsport, Tennessee.
Well, good for him, but what's the deal with Sheila? She pled guilty, then what?
Sheila was sentenced to 12 years in prison with credit for time served.
Okay, so second-degree murder. Wait, second-degree murder in 12 years? End credit for time served? Second-degree murder? She went out and bought all this shit and then dresses up like John Wayne Gacy and shot Marlene in the face in front of her son and they dealt her down to second degree? Second degree?
Yeah, it's obviously not great.
And 12 years?
They had a lot of concern about the evidence, and I'm sure there were some other considerations with witnesses, too. You figure it's all over 30 years ago. Investigators are retired or dead, witnesses have moved away, died, or you just don't even remember the details that well. And so you add all that up in a trial and it becomes really unclear, and the defense attorney has something to work with when they're arguing for reasonable doubt.
Okay, sure. But so they picked her up in 2017, 12 years puts her at like 2029, 2030. But good time or whatever horseshit nonsense you have, she's getting out sometime between not long enough and a date that'll piss me off?
Yeah, I looked it up. Based on guidelines in Florida and good time credit she already has, Sheila's anticipated release date is currently April 11th, 2025.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with us on the Brothers in Crime podcast. Feedback and suggestions are always welcome. For links and resources related to this episode, please see the show notes or visit us at brothersincrimepodcast.com. We hope you'll save, subscribe, or bookmark us on your favorite podcast site and join us for the next episode.